We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about writing, about publishing, about talking with writers, about literary criticism. And we have, as our guest, someone who has quite a bit of experience in all of those areas. Our guest in this hour is Jane Chabatari. She's the president of the National Book Critics Circle. She's also a regular blogger on their blog, Critical Mass. She was a longtime contributing editor to Parade magazine. She's worked on a number of others, including California Living, Red Book, Dial, and McCall's. She's the author of a critically acclaimed short story collection, Stealing the Fire. Her short stories have been widely published, and also her articles and book reviews have appeared in a number of major publications, just to name a few: The New York Times, The Guardian, Daily Beast, LA Times, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Tribune. She's going to be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois a week from today to take part in the Early Spring Literary Festival, something being sponsored by the Creative Writing Program. This will take place next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 15, 16, 17. There'll be readings and there'll be panel discussions, and they'll be talking about a number of things, including translation and technological change, book reviewing, the difference between literary journalism and creative nonfiction. Our guest will be appearing on a panel. She'll be taking part in a panel discussion talking about e-books. She'll also be giving a talk on the art of the book review. And on Monday, March 15th, she'll be doing a reading. That will be at the Author's Corner on the second floor of the Illini Union Bookstore, 809 South Wright Street in Champaign. In fact, I think all of the events associated with the festival are there at the bookstore. And it is open to anybody who would like to stop by. Here on the program this morning, your questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Any point here, you can call. Also, by the way, if you would like to send us your comments by email, you can do that too. And so the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point, any way that you like to do it, comments from people who are listening certainly are welcome. Ms. Chabatari, hello.
Good morning, or good noon, or almost afternoon. I'm looking forward to coming out there in a week.
Well, I'm sure the folks here are going to be happy to see you and have you take part in this program that we're doing here. This, I guess, is the first one of these things, the first of, I'm sure they hope to be many, make it a regular event.
It is the beginning of the University of Illinois Early Spring Literary Festival, as I understand. And I will be actually returning to the Midwest. I'm a Kansas native, and I taught at Knox College for a quarter a couple of years back. So it will be a pleasure to be back with you all.
Well, I'm sure that it'll be good to have you here. You know, one of the many things I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about is about the decline in book reviews and reviewing. And certainly one of the things we know is that over the last few years, newspapers have been having a difficult time. They're dealing with an economic downturn. They're dealing with loss of advertising to the internet. They're dealing with loss of readership. And so they're cutting. And one of the things a lot of papers have cut are reviews. One of the last big cuts that made a lot of news, and I know you commented on it, was when the Washington Post decided to end publication of their book world. And it was one of the last papers that actually had a freestanding book review section that was in the paper every week. They still have reviews, but I think not as much space devoted to reviews as they used to. So what's happening with book reviews? And if there are fewer reviewers, what do you think we've lost?
Well, I think the best way to talk about this issue is to say that a decade ago, most of the members of the National Book Critics Circle were staff book editors or book critics at newspapers and or magazines. In the year 2010, we as an organization have been looking at the future of book culture for the next decade. And most of our members are people who are working online and or blogging and or writing for print publications. We're diversified, if you will. Our board members are more likely to be freelancers than they are staff critics and book editors. And I think that I can explain from my own experience. I've been reading and reviewing books for quite a while and interviewing authors, and my initial reviews were appearing in print publications all around the country. I still write for some print publications, like the Chicago Tribune and Minneapolis Star Tribune. I'm working on something for them right now, and Book Forum. But I also am writing regularly for NPR.org, which is online, The Daily Beast, which is online. And it's quite a kind of fascinating experience from the critic's point of view. I'm reading and reviewing steadily as much as I was, if not more so, and the material appears more quickly. It tends to be a bit briefer, although the interviews I've been doing for the Daily Beast are, 1,200 words or 1,500 words. So there's a shift, and I think people are also adjusting to the idea. A couple of years ago, the Book Critics Circle was very concerned about this shift, and, we are in the middle of people talk about the Gutenberg Revolution. I also think about the Industrial Revolution, because we have so many technological changes happening, not just in the world of book criticism, but in the world of newspapers, magazines, and books. So we're looking at it as an opportunity, and we're beginning to look at the future of book culture and write about that steadily on our blog. We just had a series of guest posts in which our members and allies commented on their idea about the future of the next stage of book culture. And we also are getting ready to run a series on the blog about people's adventures in e-books, reading e-books from various platforms. Currently, I have to tell you, though, because we were preparing to give our National Book Critics Circle Awards on Thursday night, there's been no shift in our commitment to quality literature. And our current blog series is called 30 Books in 30 Days. Our 20-some board members each review at least one of the finalists for our awards. We have six categories. We have 30 finalists. So anyone who wants to go to our blog, www.bookcritics.org, can read all the book next decade of book culture predictions and 30 books in 30 days. And next week, they can begin reading about our adventures in e-books.
All right. Well, and questions are welcome here on the program as we talk with Jane Chavatari. We do have a caller here who's ready to go, so I don't want to make this person wait any longer on our line one in Champaign right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Here's a more general question. I think a literary critic would have a pretty good eye on the publishing industry, and I do a bit of writing myself, and I'm just fascinated by the changes in distribution and electronic publishing and so forth. In the music industry, it seems that the sales of music are sort of becoming a thing of the past, but are being used as a means of supporting live performances. That seems to be the economic model that's evolving. Could the guest talk a little bit about what she thinks the economic model for e-book publishing might become? Magazines are sort of morphing into web pages, e-books, I think, will have a great deal of future, and people are certainly reading a great deal. They're just doing it in very different forms. The economies of this, just with the music industry, are sort of archaic and having to evolve in a real hurry. So I was wondering if she could comment on that small overgeneralized.
Well, you're right in the middle of the big whirlwind of what's going to happen. We're all fascinated in watching the publishing world go digital. Matoko Rich in the New York Times did a quick cost comparison in terms of what the pricing might end up being for the future that a lot of people have been talking about. But there was a response from a slate columnist saying that actually at the moment only 2% of book sales are e-books. I think most people seem to feel that the Apple iPad will be a game changer because it will not be landlocked. It will give people opportunity to have a large enough device to read magazines and newspapers and be wireless and read books and interact and actually maybe there are some social networking platforms that are beginning to evolve as well. So we really are watching an evolution that's quite, at first seemed daunting, but I think we're now beginning to see as possibly exciting. One of the possibilities for writers is the idea that you might be able to control your own material and develop an ebook publishing situation or a relationship with distributors in which you could perhaps profit, say, 75% of the profit as opposed to the usual royalty split. So that's one of the things I'm hearing about. The moment, nobody knows for sure, so there's a lot of speculation.
Sure, yeah. Again, I was just kind of curious because this sort of spawned the indie music distribution. We've got artists who are just distributing music on their own, basically running their own labels without any real infrastructure underneath it. I was just wondering if you're seeing parallels like this beginning to evolve. I'll hang up and
listen. Yes, yeah, your comparison is a good one, absolutely.
All right, another caller. This is also someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I love to read reviews, and I used to enjoy the reviews that came with newspapers and was sorry to see them disappear. And I'm also a big mystery fan, and I wonder, are there any mystery review sheets or magazines that still exist in print, because I'm not computer literate, and I'd be interested in ordering these, but I never see them on the newsstand or at Barnes & Noble. Do you have any ideas?
Well, let me say first off that I'm not an expert or specialist in the mystery genre. However, I do steadily read the advanced publications,
mm-hmm.
Library Journal, Publishers Weekly, and so forth. And they devote great time to the mysteries as well as other publications. We also have actually terrific online mystery reviewers and critics who are specialists, and if you do decide to become computer literate, and I'm fascinated with how libraries have become the meeting ground for people who are developing an interest in reading online and downloading materials and so forth. The digital librarian is somebody who's going to, I think, help people a great deal.
So the Library Journal is one that devotes a big section to mysteries?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What?
The Library Journal.
Library Journal, which is an advanced publication. It previews books.
And can one get that in paper?
Yes, it's in paper, and you could see it at your library.
And it's called?
Library Journal.
Library Journal. Okay. And is there anything else that comes out in print that devotes a lot of time to mysteries?
Well, at the moment, there are actually mystery-oriented publications that are still, the New York Times has a standalone book review that devotes space to mystery reviews on a regular basis.
But I sometimes, you know, read little squibs that are supposed to be done, like Mystery Scene, and I Love a Mystery. And these do not print publish. They're all on the Internet?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. But Library Journal is one that is in print.
Yes.
And you can find that at the library.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And I look forward to coming out there.
Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We also have email, and if you want to send in a question, you can do it that way, will-talk, so W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And let me again just introduce our guest, Jane Chabatari. She serves as president of the National Book Critics Circle. She has written many articles and book reviews. She's done a lot of interviews with writers. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Book Forum, NPR.org, The Daily Beast, LA Times, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Tribune. I will stop there or else I'll just keep going ad nauseum. She also was longtime contributing editor to Parade magazine and also is the author of a critically acclaimed short story collection, Stealing the Fire. She's worked at some other magazines, too, Red Book, Dial, California Living, McCall's. She'll be visiting Champaign-Urbana next week. She'll be on the campus for the Early Spring Literary Festival, and she'll be talking about a number of things. She'll be taking part in a panel discussion about the rise of the e-book, the electronic book. She'll also be talking about the art of the book review. And a week from today, 4:30 in the afternoon, at the Illini Union Bookstore, she'll be doing a reading from her own work. So questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I have some other callers here I want to get to in just a second. I wonder if you think that the e-book, this certainly has the potential to revolutionize the distribution process, how people get books, and also how they read them. Do you think that this is likely to have much of any kind of effect on content, on what's in the book? Are we just simply talking about a different kind of appliance to use to read it?
I think what's going to happen and what we're beginning to hear about is a combination of... Actually, I think we're probably going to end up having a combination of print books, some possibility of print-on-demand books through a kiosk in a location where you could print out something you want. And the distribution of e-books through iPads and books and Kindles, but also through one's telephone. One of the things that's coming along that I'm reading about and I haven't seen in person yet is multiple platform options for people, for instance, in my case, who are fiction writers. I'll give you an example. The folks at various of the publishing companies are developing games based on content that are connected with the books they've published. They're going to be bringing a lot of the backlist of books back into print in ebook format. Google has 1.5 million at least books available for free downloading at the moment, and there are more to come. So the whole question of books also kind of goes backward if you think about books that have appeared in print in the past and now might be in the public domain, are being converted digitally into books that one can download. Books that have been published and widely, you know, enjoyed and reviewed and might be considered classics or books we want to keep in our libraries are being digitalized so that people can purchase them, depending on the rights. But anyway, that's, you know, the backlist is becoming a part of what the publishers are looking at. If you look at the cost of paper printing, distribution, and so forth, and also the fact that the bookstore slash book publishing model since the 30s has included the option of returning books. It's not been a great business model. I'm not a business specialist, but it's clearly not been a great business model. It is possible that for publishers, the ebook might be a preferable business model. I don't think print books are going to go away. I was fascinated when the C.G. Jung Red book, which cost hundreds of dollars, sold out at the end of December. So I mean, we have this combination of people willing to spend hundreds of dollars for a special book that almost feels like an art piece, and people also saying, well, we want to be able to download free books and the latest mystery or the latest literary novel or book of poetry, groups of, you know, 12 or 18 books at a time onto a portable device, so when we go somewhere, we don't have to be dragging lots of heavy books. So it's an interesting time, but I think we're going to end up with a combination.
Yeah.
And you asked about how books might change. We may have a lot of other things going on within the book. I mean, somebody might, for instance, have a link within the book to a video that might add to the richness of the reading experience. There have been for a while people who embed hyperlinks into short stories or novels so that a reader could take a step away from the page and read something else and come back. So I think there may be a more interactive quality to some books. I don't think that the idea of a book that you sit and read alone or that you sit and write alone is going to go away. I just think we're going to have a wider variety of possibilities and a lot more smaller niche books that might appeal to readers who want that kind of adventure.
Yeah. Well, it certainly should be the case that because the costs of distribution are so much lower with an e-book, that then that should mean that books that today aren't being published because the publisher says, well, maybe I could sell 100 copies or maybe I could sell a couple of thousand and it's just not worth it for me, that those books might actually become available because they don't have to do this speculative print run, don't have to spend the money on the books, don't have to take them back from the bookstores if they don't sell. That sounds like that's actually for writers. It's a good opportunity.
I think it will be. I'm also fascinated, by the way, with the idea of literary magazines being online. And there's a publication called Electric Literature that started about a year ago, and they are actually making their quarterly anthology of literary publication available in all the formats. They have YouTube, and they have iPhone, and they have Kindle and other ways of downloading. One of our members has just sold a short story to The Atlantic that will be available by Kindle only for several dollars. There are many things being explored, and as I said, we're in the middle of this evolution, and we're just kind of every morning I wake up and read e-book Neuter, which is written by Craig Teicher, who's an MVCC board member, just to see what's happening next, because it's happening so quickly.
Yeah. Well, we have some other
callers. There's also the idea of social networking being included, so that there might be e-readers that would come out where people could be reading them on their iPads or their iPhones and so forth, and also interact with other people via Facebook-style interaction. People love to compare favorite books, like on Goodreads. So those are other things that are being woven into the devices.
Let us talk with some other callers. We have someone in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I meet with a group of friends who are, let's say, Keiko freaks. And last time we had a conversation, and most of them have a Kindle set up, and they were starting to complain about it. And one lady got up, she says, well, the book thing I want, it's got to have something that makes me feel like I'm turning pages. And I want something wide enough so I can see the left page and the right page in case I want to skip to the back last page or something like that. I don't want to have to do all that kind of shuffling. And how in the world are they going to get that set up if I want to go back to page 13 or something? Finally, all turned out, what we had was a regular book, except that it had buttons on it so you could flip through the pages quickly and it would give the appearance of that on a screen, which was essentially, the half side of it was left, half side of it was right. And I thought, God, that was pretty strange. We're just back to the book again, except now it's in solid-state format like the book is, too, as far as that goes. And my indulgence was, I'm concerned about folios and things I'm interested in, like the history of mathematics and science. I found out that a classic textbook on celestial mechanics is available on Google, but my God, that's one page only. It's not on the back, so you've got twice as much thickness right from the jump. So I have a feeling that ergonomics is going to come in here pretty quick. And if you think so or not think so, what's your opinion about that?
Well, I'm with you in terms of having a fondness for turning the page. There have been people who've asked a number of us on the Book Critics Board and other critics, how would we feel about having e-galleys, which would be early copies of the book in advance, but on an e-book format so that we would read on a digital device or online on our computers. And I have resisted this because I like to turn the pages. I like to actually, with a galley, dog ear pages. And I like to be able to write notes to myself so that when I'm preparing a review, I can make note of page numbers for quotes and so forth. We're wondering about the iPad. I mean, we're all watching. It's going to come out in a couple of weeks. It's a very exciting time. And I understand that there will be that possibility of using your fingers to turn the page. I haven't seen it myself, so I can't guarantee that. I don't know. I think at some point, sooner or later, if the iPad tablet doesn't work that way, other devices will, because that seems to be one of the big demands that readers are making.
And
I can imagine also, I mean, I review several books a week in some cases, and in some cases, like this Sunday, yesterday's Daily Beast, I had a Hollywood book bank of five novels that are Hollywood novels to read in this Oscar season. And as I travel a lot, I can see it would be a lot easier to have on a digital device rather than dragging bags of books around with me.
Yeah.
Our National Book Critics Circle finalist awards, which will be given on Thursday, we have some pretty hefty books on that list, including William Volman's Imperial, which weighs in at, I think, more than 500 pages. So I'm with you on the convenience of having something that wouldn't be as heavy to drag around.
Well, and I guess I always thought, I had always said that my dream device would be something that would be easily portable, that could hold a number of books, magazines, newspapers. And I thought, well, okay, while we're at it, let's put in a web browser, and I could put my music on there, and it would be an all-purpose device. Well, it seems like that's pretty much where we're going. That's, I think, a pretty fair description of the iPad. About the one thing you can't do with it easily maybe is make a phone call, but you actually can make an internet phone call using an iPad. I think maybe we're just about at that point, but I also, you know, wonder whether for old folks like us who have grown up reading print books and like the conventions of the print book and feeling it and turning the pages, whether younger people, if they've pretty much grown up with screens, maybe they don't care about that, you know, and maybe they would be much more, they would have fewer problems with reading books on something like an iPad than we would if they've just always been sitting, if they've had a screen in front of them all their life, literally.
I suspect that the generation that grows up with the iPads and the other devices that are going to grow in the next several years. I mean, like any computer, I don't know if you recall, but computers didn't have easy, quick, wireless internet connections until within the last decade, if not even a shorter period. But I also see four-year-olds I know who are deeply involved in reading books as well. And, of course, we have the Harry Potter phenomenon. So I tend to think it's going to be both and.
Mm.
I've been watching it for a while, and that's my own personal opinion.
We have another caller here in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Oh, hello. I seem to have some trouble with my voice this morning. I don't understand the need for Kindle or similar devices when we already have very nice, lightweight laptop, notebook computers. And with some of the wide screen types, you could easily open the book and part of the pane and then have your word processor sitting over on the other 6 inches or 4 inches of the screen and put your notes there. And David can even make his internet messages using Skype or Gizmo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need Kindle for? You can put a terabyte.
Traveling. I talk to people who have, you know, they want to go on vacation and they want to bring a dozen books they've been eager to read.
Mm-hmm.
And they find if they download it onto a Kindle, or they're even, they can download it from where they've gone. They could go on vacation and download a book, or travel to another location and download a series of books. And part is about people are finding it convenient. They're finding it less expensive in some cases. If it's a free book or it's a book that's priced less than a hardback new version.
Well, that's all.
You can do however you choose to do it. There are also some people like to read on their telephones or who are commuting in cities and are on public transportation and want to be using smaller devices. I mean...
Well, that's all very well, but you can get a lightweight...
We all want our own individual ways of doing it. I think that's part of the challenge here for publishers is to try to reach as many committed readers as possible. Because what combines us, what connects us all is this passion for reading.
I don't know. Am I still connected?
Yeah.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Okay. I appreciate your arguments, but a lightweight laptop computer isn't going to be very much heavier than a Kindle. It has far greater utility. You can have your notepad sitting on one side of that screen and your book that you're reading in the other. You can put a terabyte drive in it and put 100 books on if you want.
Well, you make your point, and I think that if that works for you, I think that's terrific.
Well, right
there
now,
are those who are choosing Kindles and others who choose not to read e-books at all and want to stick to the paper and leather and print and convenience. You know, it's really a matter of individual preference, I think, with many options being offered to us, some more effective than others at the moment, because we are in an evolutionary process.
What I'm saying is we already have that option with the lightweight computers, which can do so much more than a Kindle.
Well, I hear you, and I think that you can certainly choose to do what you want with your computer. I'm not personally a Kindle user or a fan, but it's clearly something that people are finding, some people are finding a useful way to read.
Well, I guess that's their privilege. I just don't see the added expense. It seems to me that the computers we now have, which I admit are much more expensive than the Kindle, but do so much more. Of course, if that's you don't want to do the other things, then I guess that's superfluous. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm enjoying your program. So please go on.
Thank you for the call.
Well, and I guess I certainly take the caller's point, and I suppose also the question of the future of the e-book or the e-reader or something like the iPad or the Kindle sort of remains to be seen. How many people will take to them, and will they become popular? Will someone come along and invent something else?
Only 2% of the books being sold today are e-readers.
But I think that what seems to be the case is that overall, there, as you say, I think that there's demand for being able to get this kind of material, whether we're talking about a book or a newspaper or a magazine or a website or whatever. People want to be able to – they want to be able to get it anywhere, and they want to be able to have it on a wide range of devices. So I think that that's going to be – the material, the people who produce the material, they're going to have to make it available on all these different platforms, because that's, I think, what people want.
Yes, because the platforms are, as you pointed out earlier, David, the distribution.
Right.
So the writers want to make their work available. The publishers want to sell as many books as they can. So they're attentive to the need from some part of the population for e-books as well as other publications.
Yeah.
And also, I don't think libraries are going to go away. I think people are going to want to go into the libraries and get books off the shelves and sit there and read them or take them home and read them.
And do you think, though, that libraries are going to have to get into the business of e-book downloads, because more and more people are going to say to the library, I want to be able to read it this way? Now, and I suppose that all raises all kinds of brand new issues about
right, you are.
About
the American
rights.
Library Association has been actually involved in thinking all of this through, and I'm eager to hear Harriet Green from the University of Illinois Library, who's a digital librarian, who's on the panel I'm on March 15th at 11 o'clock, because she's clearly going to be able to answer that sort of question. I have watched in my local libraries people developing an interest in all things that have to do with the Internet and computers, so that it's not just a check-it-out place. It's also a click place, they say, the librarians.
Well, let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Jane Chabatari. She is president of the National Book Critics Circle. She's also a regular blogger on their blog Critical Mass. She was a longtime contributing editor to Parade magazine and has also worked on a number of other publications, California Living, Red Book, Dial, McCall's. She has interviewed a lot of people, performers, figures in politics, musicians, artists. She's the author of a critically acclaimed short story collection, Stealing the Fire, and also her short stories have been widely published, and then her articles and book reviews have appeared in a number of places, New York Times, Guardian, Book Forum, NPR.org, Daily Beast, LA Times, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Tribune. She's going to be here on the campus of the University of Illinois next week to take part in the Early Spring Literary Festival. She'll be taking part in a panel, as we mentioned, a panel discussion about the future of the e-book. She'll be talking about the art of the book review. She'll also give a reading from her work 1 week from today, Monday afternoon, March 15th, 4:30 in the afternoon, at the Author's Corner on the second floor of the Illini Union Bookstore. In fact, all events, they're all free and open to the public, and it's all happening there at the Illini Union Bookstore. So you can find out more about it. This is sponsored by the Creative Writing Program here at the University of Illinois. And we are certainly up for whatever questions you might have here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just yesterday, they gave out the Academy Awards. One of the changes this year the Academy made was they increased the number of films in the category for Best Picture. And they did that because they hoped that the films that were nominated, that would generate box office for the nominated films. And I'm not sure that it did or not, but at least that was their idea. Which gets me thinking about about literary awards like the National Book Critics Circle Award. I expect that the books that win the award, then they sell books. How do you balance the, on the one hand, the desire to recognize good writing and the other to promote book sales? Or do you think about that at all?
We don't think about that at all. It doesn't factor into the considerations. The National Book Critics Circle Awards have been given for 35 years. The organization started at the Algonquin Roundtable by a group of critics who wanted to expand the conversation about books to a national conversation. And that, so we think that we are a national organization. Our awards have always honored quality writing without any consideration of who the publisher is, how many sales the book has. Every year we have 24 board members all throughout the year nominating books in a password-protected whiteboard setting that were published during the year and that have come across their desk that they feel are of fine quality. Often they're books that we've reviewed. We may know about. It's not a situation where the publishers submit books. They're welcome to submit books, but we also look at and consider books that haven't been submitted by their publishers. And in a very kind of rigorous committee set up, we have awards committee chairs who conduct year-long discussions amongst each of the committees in, say, autobiography or fiction or nonfiction and poetry and biography. And we actually winnow through. We didn't start with a total of maybe 100-some books and gradually narrow it down to about 10 or 12 at the end of each year, and then we meet in January to narrow those down to our five finalists. We also give a Lifetime Achievement Award. This year we're giving it to Joyce Carol Oates for her work as an author, a critic, a small press publisher, and a teacher of writing, most recently at Princeton. And we give a Critic of the Year Award. This year it's going to Jeff McCatello of The New Yorker. So we have a history of looking and honoring quality in books without really consideration of other factors that might be part of the marketplace.
All right. Let's talk with another listener. This is someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, actually, I was going to drag back a little bit to the caller because I caught the conversation about the when the gentleman was talking about the iPad and the notebook and the whole what's the difference between the two. And one of the important features that I was looking at myself when I was looking at the whole topic itself was the fact that the iPad and the iPhone itself, essentially the first device that came out, was all that dealt with gestures. So in the difference between like a notebook as a utility and the iPad and these new tablet devices that are coming out is the fact that we have this gesturing capability, which cuts out on a lot of this, you know, typing and, you know, seeing some of the previews for this iPad tablet that's coming out and the stuff that it can accomplish. It does have that page flipping capability. And surely I've seen some of the demonstrations for like Wired magazines, you know, their layout, their new application for the iPad. And to see the actual animations and the graphics in the article itself come out at you and interact while you're reading the text is just something that, as the speaker was mentioning, the evolutionary process of this reading. So I could see that actually coming to fruition in the next, you know, couple of months when they release this device. And he just wanted to point out a couple of these interesting facts about how it might change the way we do some reading.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great point. I mean, we all are kind of fascinated about what's going to happen when the iPad is released. My understanding is that April 1st and beginning on Thursday, March 12th, the reservations are being taken. When you talk about the gesturing, what you mean is that you can use your hand to turn the pages on the screen. Is that correct?
Yeah, your hand on the screen, multiple touches, different events that can trigger different interactions with the, you know, different applications, or in this case, books or text in that matter.
Yes. No, it's going to be fascinating, and that is why we've been talking about how things might change. There, it's just going to be a different kind of opportunity for those who choose to read on devices.
Yes, definitely. And the one other last thing was the fact that, you know, that when people think about space and capacity, and this device has, you know, this limitation of how much disk space. I mean, this is going to be non-existent in the next couple of months with the whole, there's another movement also, this cloud movement, this whole cloud computing movement where all your storage is basically non-existent on the devices and it's handled by a provider somewhere else on the web. So in that case, you could have entire libraries of text, or you could have unlimited basically amounts of storage where you can harbor all this information off the device itself. So this is something that will be very interesting to watch as well.
Oh, that's a very good point about the cloud computing. It's something that I, as a writer, find really promising because of I have manuscripts of a short story collection and a novel I'm working on that it takes up memory, let's face it. And I review steadily and I have, you know, drafts of various things all over my computer, and having things like this in the cloud really frees up my computer to move faster.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the comment. Let's go on to somebody else, and this would be someone listening in Tolono, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Could you comment on the popularity of audiobooks as compared to all these electronic forms? It would seem to me that for fiction, anyway, that audiobooks would be more preferable than all these Kindles and new devices. And I'll hang up now. Thank you.
Well, we certainly do love audiobooks. I know a lot of people who use them to travel. My husband and I drove I-80 across the country twice this past summer, and it's just wonderful to drive and know that you're being careful on the wheel. You're not texting or doing anything that would get in the way, and listen to wonderful stories. We were actually listening to the stories of John Cheever, which read very well on audiobooks on travels. So, yes, and I actually also have awareness of people who might be have difficulty seeing, and audiobooks are wonderful. We have family relatives who are using audiobooks from through the Library of Congress and other and from publishers who are able to keep up with the reading experience through those. And they certainly are portable. Yes, good point.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333 800-222-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something that just this conversation about cloud computing brings to mind, I think that there are some people who, one concern about moving to the digital world that they voice, it's something like this. It's that the content providers, if they really had it their way, their preference would be, whether we're talking about a movie, a television show, a piece of music, a piece of writing, they would prefer that they continue to own it and that we just rent it and that we pay for the right to use it, but that we don't ever actually have physical ownership. Now, in some cases, that might be just fine, but I wonder whether you think about that and what the difference is between, say, having electronic access to a whole library full of books on the one hand, and the other being able to sit there and sit beside your bookshelf and reach out and touch the books and know that these are yours.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. I have not committed enough to e-books to be able to answer personally.
Yeah.
I adore books. My husband and I both are writers, and we have books going back to graduate school. We have books that were childhood favorites. We have books that are our novel group favorites. I mean, there is something just very special about the feeling you have about books. My husband actually has certain books in several versions. John Leonard was a founding, the New York Times critic who died last year, was a founding member of the Book Critics Circle, and he made a comment one time that really stayed with me. The books we love us back. I think there's a connection to the solid book that is almost part of being a passionate book lover.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see, but I don't think regular books are going to go away. And the idea of having it to go pull back out of the shelf and refer to when you want has always been sort of a glorious thing. I remember going to libraries and checking books out and then being able to have a book that was mine and I could have it on the shelf. It meant a lot to me. Only having a short story for 6 months or access to it or a collection, I don't know how that will all work. But I do know that I go into libraries and bookstores and browse, and I don't want to have every book in my library. So once again, we might have a combination.
Yeah. We have maybe about 4 or 5 minutes left, and one of the things that you're going to be talking about when you're here is book reviewing. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that. You could talk a little bit about that, just to give a synopsis of a book that's maybe not all that difficult, but there's a big difference between that and what I think everybody would agree that a book review can be, provided that you're allowed the space to do that kind of writing. For you, what would be the best qualities of a book review?
What I work for myself as a critic, and what I work for when I look for books, is sort of the bottom line do I want to read this book? Mm-hmm. But secondly, I want context. If it's a relatively new author, I'd like to know what area that person's work falls into. If it's somebody like Richard Powers, who's novel Happiness I reviewed last fall for NPR.org, I was challenged to describe his work to date. Similarly with Margaret Atwood, whose most recent novel I reviewed this past fall for NPR.org. And I think a good review will give context and will also give you a brief sense of what it feels like to read the book.
Mm.
And, you know, that's a tricky thing to do. You also want to feel like the reviewer is somebody who's connecting with you. And I must say, one of the things I've found in reviewing over the years is that I've learned a lot as a fiction writer from the craft of fiction through osmosis and through analysis. And one of the things I've learned as a reviewer is that great writers can write bad books. And first-time authors can fail in a lot of different ways. So it's always sort of heartening to know that a really beautifully written book is hard to produce. I mean, it's really hard to write a perfect book. Very few people do it. But we have the opportunity to point out to review, you know, through reviews, what works in a book, what's the best part of it, that kind of comparison.
And I certainly, because I talk to a lot of writers, mostly people who write nonfiction, I read a lot of reviews. And I think, though, that I probably have not seen very many reviews that have said something like, this book is an outright failure. There are reviews that are enthusiastic and some that are less so. And perhaps I haven't read enough reviews. Are there many reviews that end up getting published that are just that, a review,
yes,
that would essentially,
yes,
say, you know, this is just
the answer is yes.
Yes, there are.
Sorry, yes. Sorry for the authors of all, but I actually recently wrote a review about a novel that was so not working that at the end I recommended two other novels or two other books that one could read if they were interested in that material.
And you said you felt bad about that? That is saying
well,
that the one book was bad.
As an empathetic person, you know, it's always sad for me to think an author has written a book and poured their heart and soul into it, and it's not working. But as a critic, it's my job to point that out to possible readers.
Mm-hmm. Are people who publish reviews, are they at all reluctant to publish a negative review?
Not that I'm aware of, certainly not people who I'm aware of through my work with the National Book Critics Circle.
Huh.
It comes up. It's just one of those factors. It's one's job to say, how's it working? You know, I think that's why people want what they call curators or gatekeepers. I think that's why the role of the critic will continue, because total enthusiasm for every book, in a way, is unfair to readers, because we have limited time, we have limited resources. If you're going to buy a book in hardcover, you want it to be something you're going to understand. You know what to expect on some level, and you need a feeling for the context. I'll give you another example. Is that writing about and reviewing books that are written by, say, someone who's from another country, or sometimes people don't know that they might want to read a book in translation if they don't understand the context from which the author is writing. So I have a strong interest in international affairs from my years traveling out of the country as a journalist. So I have a fondness for books that are written by authors from other countries, either in translation or in English. And I often review books that need to give a cultural context to what the work is, as a way of helping.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but we're here at the end of the time. I'll just say one more time that our guest, Jane Chabatari, president of the National Book Critics Circle, longtime writer and book reviewer. She'll be here on the campus for the Early Spring Literary Festival next week, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program. That's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's been terrific, David. Maybe I'll see you next week.
And programs here on WILO, made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Danu on March 16th and the San Francisco Symphony March 18th. More information on these and other events at krannertcenter.com. WILO thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall, for public telecommunication. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our monthly look at diet and nutrition with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. She'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. In Kansas City, March wheat is trading at $4.94. That's up 1. May, $5.03, up 2.5. In Chicago, March wheat, $4.87 and a quarter, up 5. May, $4.95 and 3 quarters.